From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. A few months ago, we sent our producer, Reagan Edelman, out to Utah's West Desert to cover the return of a space capsule that was thought to be carrying a sample of rocks taken from the surface of an asteroid called Bennu. It was a journey of billions of miles, but NASA's leaders felt it was worthwhile for two major reasons. First, Bennu makes a close approach to Earth every 6 years, and in about 160 years, it's likely that our paths will cross close enough that a collision could happen. And as it turns out, the potential of colliding with a large asteroid is something NASA takes pretty seriously. So this trip was a scouting mission to understand what we might be up against if we are going to prevent this aircraft carrier-sized rock from crashing into our home. But there was another reason why scientists wanted to send a spacecraft to Bennu and to return with a sample. And that's because this asteroid is more than just a pile of rocks. As the mission's scientific leader, Dante Loretta, explained it back when the capsule returned to Earth in September of 2023, Bennu is a scientific time capsule from the very beginning of our solar system. It's a long-lost sibling, so to speak, and it may contain some of the same building blocks for life that have resulted in the seeming uniqueness of our planet. If we want to understand how we got to be here, Bennu might have the clues we need. If you listen to Reagan's report, you might also recall Loretta explaining how he began working on this project in February of 2004, when the concept was formulated on a cocktail napkin at a bar in Tucson, Arizona. And now, in his new book, Loretta is filling in what happened before and after that fateful meeting, en route to a successful mission to and from an asteroid that is billions of years old and might be on a collision course with our planet. The book is called The Asteroid Hunter, A Scientist's Journey to the Dawn of Our Solar System. Dante Loretta, welcome.
Thank you, Matthew. It's great to be here.
Dante, one of the things I really enjoyed about spending time with Reagan in Utah's West Desert when your team was preparing for the return of the sample last year was getting to know this really diverse cast of characters, a lot of whom came from really surprisingly humble beginnings, and they now work for the most well-known and influential space agency in the world. So I wanted to start today with your humble beginnings. Can you tell me about growing up off the grid?
My family and I lived in a remote part of the Arizona desert called New River. It's in between Phoenix and Flagstaff and off to the east of I-17. And we lived in a trailer, single wide trailer. We didn't have water. We had to drive miles to fill a big tank every couple of weeks. Didn't really have a television for the longest time. So I was kind of stuck entertaining myself. And that's when I began exploring. And I wandered out into the Arizona desert and really became enamored with the various life forms that are out there, the amazing geology that I could find, and the sense of wonder when you come across something, you know, maybe people haven't seen for 100 years or more.
And the night skies in places like this are just, for a kid who is seeking wonder, such an amazing part of the scenery.
Yeah, Arizona is famous for its dark skies, and it was always there with me as I was growing up, looking off into the stars with this amazing sense of awe, and quite honestly, being a little intimidated by my scale relative to the time and the space that's out there.
You had parents who were often fighting. Your father struggled with some addiction issues. Your mom kicked your dad out of the home when you were 12. You had to help raise your two younger siblings. And somehow you wound up not just going to college at the University of Arizona, but doing so as a theoretical math major.
I didn't know anything about college. I mean, really, nobody in my family had been to college. I'd never been on a college campus before. Everything I knew, I got from the movies. Back in the 80s, one of my favorites was Revenge of the Nerds. And that's kind of the vision I had of what college would be like if I went there. And of course, when I got to high school, I started working. I was really good at math. It was my favorite subject. And it just clicked for me. I thought that way. It was very consistent with how my brain worked. And when I got to the University of Arizona and they asked me to pick a major, I didn't really know what that meant, but I thought to myself, boy, you're really good at math. So how about math? And I remember the registration desk, they kind of gave me this funny look and they're like, wow, we don't hear that very often.
And you didn't know where it was going to take you. You weren't at that time dreaming about working for NASA. That's an idea that you had from reading an advertisement in the student newspaper one day.
Yeah, I had spent 4 years at U of A working on that math degree, and I got ready to graduate, and I just felt like, what am I going to do? I didn't have any options. I didn't have any jobs lined up. So I took a look at where I was. I had been taking a lot of physics classes. I kind of morphed from my early days being very theoretical, almost to the point of considering math as a construct of the human mind. And then I got into physics and I was like, okay, math actually works really well to describe how the universe works, very predictive in its capabilities. And I studied Japanese and I fell in love with Japan, its culture, history, and language. And I was like, I could finish off a physics major and an East Asian studies major if I just spend one more year in school and maybe something will open up for me. And I got a job as usual, working as a breakfast cook and hoping for something to show up. I found the student newspaper and there was an ad that said, work for NASA. And that changed my whole direction in life.
Your first ambition was to search for extraterrestrial intelligence. The head of the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at the University of Arizona at the time was a guy named Eugene Levy. You've described this guy as a very daunting man, and he had a two-word answer for you when you told him what you wanted to do.
Yeah, I fell in love with the SETI program. It was really big in the early 90s. NASA was actually funding a SETI program.
This is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Yeah, thank you. And I was blown away. I was like, this is a job? You're paying me to talk to an esteemed professor about alien civilizations? And what are we going to do if we find one? How are we going to communicate with them? That was my assignment for my final year in college. And I thought, this is it. This is amazing. This is what I want to do. And I started looking at graduate programs where I could pursue that, which really wasn't obvious. But I started with my home university, went to the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory, met with the department head, Gene Levy, and I told him what I wanted to do. And he said, hell no.
Were you just, I think you wrote in the book that it was like a needle pierced your heart.
It was totally devastating because I had been searching for something and I thought I found it. And then as soon as I try to approach one of the professors, an esteemed member of the community, it's just shot down immediately. But the good news was he was encouraging. That wasn't where he ended the conversation. He said, look, first of all, SETI is under political attack. There was a senator from Nevada who made it his mission to get the program canceled, and he succeeded in that. But NASA was starting to invest in Mars exploration, so Dr. Levy encouraged me to go to graduate school and work on Martian geology, Martian history, thinking about life on Mars. So it was related to what I wanted to do, but it was also connected to a NASA flight program.
There's a lot of history between that point, this point when you began focusing on space, and then this moment in 2004 that you found yourself at the Audubon bar with your boss, Mike Drake, and a guy from Lockheed Martin named Steve Price. But I do want to bring us to this point in the story, because this is the point in which, in sort of a roundabout way, you got to come back to the search for extraterrestrial life.
I had always had that secret desire in my heart. And I said, well, let's pursue a science career and find ways to connect what you're doing to this big concept. I had really embraced the space science career, went to graduate school, and I moved on to star formation and planet formation and really thinking about habitable worlds. How do you build something like the Earth where it's even possible for life to get started?
When you were invited onto this project by Mike Drake and Steve Price, was it immediate that that connection was there? That this idea that getting our hands on pristine ancient asteroid material might tell us more than ever about how life might have formed on our planet and might potentially form in other places? Or is that something you sort of like realized along the way as you were plotting out how this project that came to be known as the OSIRIS Project came about?
Yeah, so I had been working on meteorites for the past decade or so before that meeting took place. And meteorites are fragments mostly from asteroids, although a few rare ones come from the moon and also from Mars. And the asteroidal samples are ancient and very diverse. So I understood the scientific rationale really well. But the loss of Mars Observer had left a deep scar on my psyche. And the thought of getting involved in a spacecraft mission very early in my career was daunting and risky. And I wasn't sure that it was something I wanted to sign up for, because it's a project, as we are talking about now, that spanned decades. And signing up for something like that when you're 33 years old, it's not easy.
One of the things that you focused on early on was an idea that is quite popular in science fiction, this potential for this mission to be something of a proof of concept endeavor for asteroid mining. How important was that to selling this idea to NASA?
Yeah, it's really amazing. As I was starting to craft the science objectives for the mission, I looked across the scientific landscape and identified several different communities that would really get on board with this program. One was the cosmochemists. Those are people like me in the lab analyzing meteorites and lunar samples. Others are astronomers looking at asteroids through telescopes, trying to understand their physical properties and their orbits. And then there was this group called the In-Situ Resource Utilization Community, people that were thinking about economic resources that are in near-Earth space that could catalyze future exploration. I was enamored with that idea from the beginning, and I thought this would be a great proof of concept. Get out to an asteroid, get material from its surface, and bring it back to the Earth. I call it a spec sample, which is what the mining industry refers to when you go out to see if there's something of economic value that you might want to develop into a future mine. So I embraced it. I'm a sci-fi geek. I'm proud of it. And I folded that right into the mission objectives.
So you have all these mission objectives, you bring them to NASA, you're pretty excited about it, you were reasonably confident about it, and then the first proposal bombs.
So it was a little bit of a gut punch, but the team was starting to click, and the good news was a new opportunity was coming in the next year, and we felt like, okay, you stumbled, you don't give up after one try, right? Let's go for this again and see how far we can push the concept.
You first came to know Bennu as an asteroid that was originally called 1999 RQ36. It was discovered in 1999. So this was a newly known asteroid when all of this is going down. What was it about this asteroid that, as I said, later came to be known as Bennu, that shot it to the top of the list of candidates for a visit and helped drive the impetus for NASA to eventually say, yes, we're going to support this, and yes, we're going to support it for a long time?
Every 6 years, Bennu comes close to the Earth. It's in a very Earth-like orbit, which is why it might hit us. We looked at its size. It was pretty big. We wanted something big because the small asteroids, many of them spin very rapidly. They're probably just a single boulder with no loose material that we could sample. And then the clincher was its brightness. It's really dark. We wanted that carbon, and that was our best chance of getting carbonaceous asteroid sample to Earth.
Tell me about the importance of carbon here, because this really is key.
Everything that's going on in biology has carbon as the central element. We believe it is key to life on Earth, not just the element itself, but the molecule that it's inside of. And it addresses one of the biggest challenges in science. How do you go from organic, rich, non-biological material to something that's alive? That is still a profound change in the state of matter and energy that we don't understand. And we think steps along that path played out in the interior of asteroids and maybe even in the protoplanetary disk and the interstellar medium before our solar system existed.
And so here you have this sort of dual purpose of this mission emerging. Bennu, it could tell us about our start. And also, Bennu, it could spell our end. This is becomes a really compelling story, not just to NASA, but a lot of people around the world who latched on to this mission.
Yeah, asteroids are potentially the bringers of life and the harbingers of death. Everybody's familiar with the idea that 65 million years ago, a much larger asteroid than Bennu crashed into the Yucatan and triggered the extinction of the non-avian dinosaurs. And that's why the mission is named after Osiris. Osiris is an Egyptian deity. We think that Osiris may have been the first pharaoh bringing civilization to the Nile Delta. But he ended poorly, and he became the god of the afterlife. And you meet Osiris in Egyptian mythology upon passing, and he judges you and decides where you're going to spend the afterlife. So I really like the idea that asteroids have this dual life and death aspect, and Osiris did as well. And that's why the mission was named for him.
We're going to make a very long story short here, cut to three really important dates in your life and the history of this mission. First, Dante, tell me about September 8, 2016.
Yeah, September 8th of 2016 is where all of our hard work paid off. The first 7 years of the program was proposal after proposal after proposal, getting better and convincing NASA to fly. And then 5 years of design, build, test, and delivery of the spacecraft to Cape Canaveral, where we put it on top of an Atlas V rocket and launched it out into the solar system to begin its 7-year journey to Bennu and back. It was an amazing time. I got to spend about 3 months in Florida on a beachfront condo with my family. And I went to work every day at the Kennedy Space Center. It was a great drive. I just felt like pinching myself constantly. You're like, wow, you're about to launch a spacecraft. You're working at Cape Canaveral. You're seeing rocket launches every couple weeks or so. And it's just a phenomenal time period. The mood was exuberant and also a little tense because you could lose the whole thing. Right there and then, all that work could have been over in an instant if there was an anomaly during the launch.
And so it does launch. It launches successfully. And there's this dual feeling that you go through, which is, on the one hand, relief, everything that went well. And on the other hand, a realization that that end is really just the beginning, because you've got a long way to go before this thing does the next really big thing that it's going to do. That happens on October 20th of 2020, when after about 2 years in transit and another 2 years orbiting Bennu, you guys say it's time to land this thing.
You know, spaceflight is really a game of patience. It's unbelievable to me that I'm talking to you 20 years now after that first meeting when we decided to go for this. We got to Bennu in late 2018, and it was a shocker. It did not look like what we expected. It was a much rougher, rugged, boulder-strewn surface when we had been expecting something smooth and sandy and beach-like. So we spent a year agonizing over every little patch of asteroid surface. We had to improve the guidance capability of the spacecraft, inventing a brand new technique called natural feature tracking. All of that culminated in October of 2020. The world seemed like it was falling apart, and we're trying to fly a spacecraft that's over 200 million miles away, and we're trying to drop it into a really tiny crater about the size of a parking lot. So it was an enormous, tense moment that I will never forget. The good news is it worked. We got the spacecraft down. We got an amazing sample. We got away intact, and we were ready for the journey home.
You almost didn't. The asteroid almost sucked in the lander when it came down, because the surface was so sandy and silty, right?
Yeah, Bennu is the trickster. And the surface is rough. It's rugged. It's full of boulders. It looks solid, like you think you could go down and walk on the surface of the asteroid. And that's what we expected. We expected to touch down into a tough surface with some material right there that we could scoop up, like little pebbles and gravel and dust. It turns out microgravity really messes with your mind. We just are not used to thinking about the way physical material behaves when you take gravity out of the equation. So when we hit the surface, there was no resistance. We just kept going down and sinking And I honestly believe if we had not fired the back away thrusters, we would have lost the spacecraft. It would have just disappeared like into a pit of quicksand.
But it doesn't. It gets away, and you're pretty sure pretty quickly that it has successfully captured some of this soil. And you're not going to know at that point for 3 more years until we finally get to September 24th, 2023, when OSIRIS makes its voyage back in close proximity to Earth and it drops off this capsule.
Yeah, we left Bennu in May of 2021, and that was really constrained by orbital dynamics. So even after the sample collection event, we had to hang around for another 7 months. And then it was another 2.5 years from departure to get back to the Earth. And that's when we released the sample return capsule, targeting an atmospheric entry interface that would get us on the ground in the western Utah desert. And that happened on September 24th of 2023.
And you must have just been holding your breath.
Oh my goodness.
For this whole time.
Yeah, it was a crazy, crazy day. I got up really early in the morning, about 1:30 a.m. local time, because we had some spacecraft activities to perform, especially to decide if we were going to release the capsule. There was a chance we were going to hang on to it if there were any safety concerns. But the good news is our flight dynamics team is the best in the world. They targeted the entry perfectly, and we came down just as we expected in Utah. It hit the top of the atmosphere, moving at over 27,000 miles per hour. And there was a key moment where we needed to have the parachute deploy. That was supposed to happen at an altitude of 100,000 feet, and it didn't. And I knew that. I was in a helicopter flying out to the field site, getting ready to welcome that capsule home. And the safety officer from the Air Force is telling me there's no parachute. And I'm just thinking, oh man, we've come so far and we're going to crater into the Utah desert. And I'm going to have to get in front of all those cameras and I'm going to be an emotional wreck. Fortunately, 3 minutes later, for some reason, the main parachute deployed and it arrested the velocity and the capsule came down for a nice gentle landing in Utah. And it looked perfect. It was sitting right on its nose cone like a gymnast that had just stuck the landing.
We are now just months into the process of studying the sample that the capsule brought back to us, but we already know some very interesting things, including some of the compositional elements, magnesium phosphate, glycine, carbonite, sulfites, olivine, and magnetite. As someone so interested in this question of the origins of life and the potential existence of life outside of Earth, what does this tell you?
These samples are amazing. Everything I dreamed about all the way back in 2004 has come to fruition. First of all, the dominant phase is a mineral called serpentine. This is a clay mineral, and it tends to have a very wavy structure. It's not like a solid crystalline form, like a serpent, which is why we call it that. And these rocks on Earth, they form at the mid-ocean ridge, where you have mantle rock, which is that olivine that you referred to primarily, interacting with ocean water. And it reacts vigorously and it turns the rocks into clay. The other thing that's really exciting is it is loaded in carbon. 4.7 weight percent of the sample is the element carbon. That is the highest concentration that we have measured in our laboratories for analysis of these samples. The carbon is dominantly in organic molecules. About 10% of the carbon is in minerals called carbonates, which most people are familiar with as the white kind of crusty salts that grow around your faucets or taps if you live in an area with hard water. So it looks like something from the bottom of the Earth's ocean. It must have come from a world that had both rocky and liquid water interacting with each other. Lots of carbon, lots of organics, important organic molecules like amino acids and nucleic acids are being discovered. It's an astrobiologist's dream.
So the building blocks are there.
The building blocks of life are contained in the samples from asteroid Bennu.
That's Dante Loretta. He is a professor of planetary science and cosmochemistry at the University of Arizona. And since 2011, he has served as the principal investigator of the NASA mission to return a sample from the asteroid Bennu. His new book is called The Asteroid Hunter. Dante Loretta, thank you.
Thank you, Matthew. It's been great.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. And that's also where you'll find producer Reagan Edelman's episode on the asteroid sample return. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. And from listeners like you, you can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot, and I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.